Hello and welcome to the TA teleconference, How Authors Can Navigate Successfully Through Copyright-Related Issues, presented by C. Jeffrey Belliston and Elsa Peterson. Elsa is a freelance editor with 25 years experience in the college textbook industry. She has been doing editorial work primarily for the college textbook industry since 1984. Although her academic background is in music, she holds a BA with highest honors from the University of California at Riverside and an MA from Case Western Reserve University. Her versatile editing talents have led her into a wide variety of disciplines, ranging from the arts and humanities to psychology, business and management, human physiology and nutrition, and foreign language. She was a senior development editor for psychology with McGraw-Hill Higher Education and has freelanced for virtually every leading textbook publisher in the U.S. In addition to manuscript development, she is experienced in permissions editing, picture research, and writing content for textbook ancillaries. Based in Norwalk, Connecticut, Elsa offers a discount to TA members who use her editing services. Jeffrey was appointed Scholarly Communications Librarian in the Harold B. Lee Library at Brigham Young University in September 2007. He also heads up the library's Office of Digital Content Management. Previously, Jeffrey chaired the General Information Services Department in the library and led the implementation of the Information Commons. As Scholarly Communications Librarian for Brigham Young, Belliston oversees the university's Open Access Repository, BYU Scholars Archive, the BYU installation of Open Journal Systems, which is used to help journals produced at BYU or edited by BYU faculty, use a web-based workflow and publishing platform, including Open Access Publishing, the university's effort to implement a digital preservation program. He also works with the Library and Scholarly Communications Advisory Council to develop programs aimed at educating campus faculty and students about relevant scholarly communication issues. Chief among those is open access. And I want to remind those who are called in to press 4-star to mute yourself. We are recording the call, and it just minimizes background noises. If you want to ask a question, you just press 4-star again to unmute yourself. All right, now I turn the teleconference over to Jeffrey and Elsa.
Well, thanks, Kim, and it's so nice to be invited to speak to everyone today. I'm Elsa Peterson, and I'll just start with a quick disclaimer. I am not a lawyer, so please don't interpret any of this as legal advice.
I am not a lawyer either. This is Jeff Belliston. I'm glad to be here. I don't have any formal training in copyright. My experience with copyright comes from working with faculty here who are either publishing or have published in journals, and mostly with their respect to ability to deposit their articles in our open access repository. I also am aware of issues where copyright and copyright clearance have impacted services we can offer in academic libraries for our students and faculty. The bottom line is that please don't interpret the teleconference as legal advice. And we want to begin by just giving you a quick overview in case you didn't print out the handout for the conference of what it is that we're covering. We're going to go over the basics of what copyright is and what it doesn't cover, talk about the public domain for works that aren't under copyright, talk about fair use of copyrighted materials, so what you don't need to get permissions for, then a discussion of permissions, requesting approvals to reproduce copyrighted materials in your works if that's necessary, avoiding plagiarism, and finally, some legislation affecting authors, publishers, and others concerned with copyright. And we hope to take your questions at the end. Please jot them down so you don't forget them so that we can indeed deal with them. And for those that we don't get a chance to deal with in the teleconference, we would invite you to email both of us those questions, and we'll do our best to answer them. So back to Elsa.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Jeff. So copyright basics. This will be a review for some of you, but just quickly, and we are watching our time here. Copyright is the right to reproduce, the right to copy, the right to prepare derivative works such as translations or adaptations, the right to perform a work in public, which of course applies heavily to music and dramatic works, and to display the work in public. Copyright belongs to the author as soon as the work is fixed in a tangible form. That can be on film, it can be in a computer code, it can be on a piece of paper. There are a number of categories of works that are protected that are listed on the U.S. Copyright Office website. Literary works, musical works, dramatic works, pantomime and choreography, pictorial and sculptural works, motion pictures and other audio visuals, sound recordings, and architecture.
Copyright does not protect everything. There are two classes of materials that don't enjoy copyright protection: those which cannot be copyrighted under the statute, and those which are in the public domain. I'm going to cover those which can't be copyrighted, and then after she talks about how to register a copyright, Elsa will address the public domain in more depth. Copyright does not protect anything that is not fixed in a tangible form. An example of that I pulled off of our own copyright licensing website is choreographic works that have not been notated or recorded. They essentially exist in the choreographer's head. Also, spontaneous speeches that haven't been written or recorded. This means that your conversations throughout the day don't have a copyright so long as you don't have yourself bugged and nobody else is recording them. Other things that cannot be copyrighted include titles, names, short phrases and slogans, familiar symbols or designs, mere variations of typographic ornamentation, lettering, or coloring, and the mere listing of ingredients or contents. Ideas, procedures, methods, systems, processes, concepts, principles, discoveries, or devices. So, Einstein's theory of relativity cannot be copyrighted. However, we need to keep in mind that a description or an explanation or an illustration of something like the theory of relativity could be protected by copyright. And finally, works consisting of entirely of information that is common property contains no original authorship. Things like standard calendars, height and weight charts, tape measures and rulers, and lists of common facts. None of those kinds of things can be protected by copyright.
Thanks, Jeff. For how to register a copyright, I didn't want to spend time on this, but if you go to the copyright website, and I've put this in the handout, copyright.gov/document.html, the instructions for how to register a copyright are there. The forms are there. They are free. It's all done electronically now. It was about 2 years ago that they switched over. They were still accepting registrations on paper, but they would also accept them electronically. I believe now the whole process is electronic. And so, again, I don't want to spend time on how to do that, but the instructions are there, and you can also call people at the Library of Congress to get more detailed instructions. Moving on to works that are public domain, works that are not under copyright. First of all, public domain should not be confused with publicly accessible information. You can find information in the library in all sorts of publications. Most of those publications are under copyright. So being public domain is not the same thing as being not a secret. Public domain means that the work is not under copyright, and there are two major categories. One is U.S. government publications, and that is because the U.S. government takes the position that taxpayers have already paid to have these publications authored, and so they can be freely quoted. If you have a report from the Centers for Disease Control, you can quote from it. You, of course, should cite where you got the information, but you don't have to ask for permission, and you don't have to pay them a fee or anything to use material from that report. The other category is works that used to be under copyright, but whose copyright has expired. And we could spend an entire hour talking about duration of copyright because it is kind of complex. But the rule of thumb is essentially that anything published in 1922 or earlier is in the public domain now. In 2016, the clock will start moving, and it'll go from 1922, it'll become 1923, 1924, and so on. Those of you who are as old as I am will remember a time when 1922 was not the cutoff date, and the reason is because in 1998, Congress passed a Copyright Extension Act. It's known as the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, and it was retroactive. It extended the term of copyright by an extra 20 years. So the clock sort of stopped, and the clock will start moving again unless Congress passes another Copyright Extension Act. For works that are being written now, the copyright depends on the life of the author. So if you publish something and you own the copyright, that copyright will last for your life plus 70 years. And then we have some resources in the handout for more information on public domain. Jeff has found three of them. Do you want to briefly tell us what those are, Jeff? I don't know if we might have lost Jeff.
Sorry. I had muted myself to avoid background noise here.
Oh.
Thank you for the reminder. The first of the resources is called the Digital Copyright Slider, and it allows kind of a graphic way of seeing what is and isn't in the public domain or what may or may not be in the public domain. The Cornell Copyright Information Center goes a little bit beyond that in that they also talk about foreign works. But it's frankly not as easy to use as the Digital Copyright Slider. And the last thing I want to mention is a license created by Creative Commons. They call it the CC0 license, and it's a means of purposely placing one of your works, or other people also use it, they place it in the public domain. Actually, it's pretty hard to give up moral rights conferred by U.S. law, so the CC0 license from Creative Commons is the closest I'm aware of that you can come to saying, I assert no rights over this. Anybody is welcome to use it and do anything they want with it. Just be aware of those things. And now back to Elsa to begin talking about fair use.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. And fair use is a gray area in the law. We could spend not only an hour talking about fair use, we could probably spend a whole day talking about it. But essentially, in a U.S. copyright law, there are four factors that are listed to be taken into consideration in determining whether a particular use of copyright material can be considered a fair use. And when it's a fair use, it means that you didn't need to ask for anybody's permission, you didn't need to pay a fee, you could just go ahead and use it while, of course, giving credit to the source. So these four factors are, briefly, the purpose and character of the use, including whether it's a nonprofit or not. Second, the nature of the copyrighted work. Third, the amount and substantiality of the portion that's being used. And number four, the effect of the use upon the potential market for the work. So this third factor, the amount and substantiality of the portion being used, that's the thing that publishers tend to go by. In reality, they certainly can't look at every little quoted passage, every little figure or table that's going to be reproduced in a book and have their legal department evaluate whether it could be a fair use or not. So what they tend to do is have guidelines that they tell their authors, and if they hire freelance permissions editors, they tell them these guidelines, and they're usually based on how many words are being used. So they will say anything under 200 words is okay as fair use as long as the source is cited. If you're just using one figure or table from a book, you can consider that a fair use. Different publishers have different guidelines. I think the strictest that I have seen is 50 words from an article, essay, or other short work, 200 words from a book. The most liberal that I've probably seen is 500 words across the board. And so in practice, even though there are no percentages, there are no word limits in the law, in practice, most publishers have guidelines about this. And I think Jeff found a couple of good resources for us on that, too.
There are librarycopyright.net, same thing that had the Digital Copyright Slider, also has a fair use evaluator. It's not legal advice, but it walks you through those four factors that Elsa has talked about and lets you say, okay, this is an educational use. I'm using approximately this much. And you reach a determination, or you're considering those four factors holistically and coming up with an idea of whether it's probably or probably not a fair use. Stanford University Libraries have a copyright office or a copyright and fair use site. that has a lot of good information as well. So I'd recommend that you use them. Elsa, do you want to give any other examples, or should I talk a little more about this?
I think I could give an example.
Okay.
Say you're going to use a quote of 200 words from a literary work in a textbook that you're authoring. And so if you look at the purpose and character of the use, maybe you're using it in criticism, not in the sense of saying that it's poorly written or anything, but you're looking at, well, what was the author trying to do here? And then your textbook is for profit. So on the first factor, both of those would argue basically against fair use. So the purpose and character, you're not doing anything derogatory, but you're also not promoting it. So that basically on factor number one, that would sort of argue against it being fair use, especially the fact that it's not nonprofit. Second, the nature of the copyrighted work, is it from a really, really hot bestseller that's currently flying off the shelves, or is it a relatively obscure work that you're bringing to the public's attention? So that would really depend on what it is that you're quoting from. The third one is the amount and substantiality. Okay, you're using 200 words. Let's say it's from a novel that's 400 pages long. So you're using a pretty small passage from it. That would argue in favor of it being a fair use. And fourth one, the effect of the use upon the potential market. You could argue that you're increasing the market because you're bringing it to the attention of all the people who are going to buy your textbook. So it's still a judgment call. And again, it would depend on your publisher's guidelines as to whether that would be considered fair use or not. But you probably wouldn't go to jail. I mean, if you can argue fair use, if somebody comes back and says you've infringed my copyright, you can say, well, look at these four factors. I really think my use was a fair use, and I did cite you as the source. Then the worst that could probably happen is that they would ask you in the future, you have to get my permission, but they're not going to go back and prosecute you for a willful infringement.
Okay.
Shall we move on to permissions?
I want to say a few more things about fair use, where they might come in terms of research. The statute specifically mentions, quote, reproduction in copies for such purposes as scholarship or research. I don't know if you're like me, but I suspect many authors are. One of my common practices is to make copies of articles that bear on the research that I am participating in. Not always does the library here at BYU subscribe to these periodicals. And I have, on occasion, requested, say from a themed issue, articles that we haven't subscribed to. I've been turned down by the Interlibrary Loan Office from getting all of those articles because they say, that's not a fair use. You're asking for the entire issue of the journal via ILL. You need to buy it, even when it is not available for purchase. So occasionally, you can run into situations where you believe the use is fair, but you still can't get the articles because you don't have access to them. And that comes from libraries interpreting the guidelines of what was called the Conference on Fair Use. These were, I emphasize the word guidelines. They have no force of law. And they said, if you take more than 20%, you've taken too much. So you could run into that. You also might run into similar kinds of things if you actually want to put articles on reserve for your students if you are a faculty member. So let's see. I had one on the... Oh, and I would also suggest this. Be aware of your rights as a copyright holder. Before you sign a copyright transfer agreement, simply transferring all those rights to a journal publisher, make certain that you have retained the right to use your own materials and colleagues at your institution have the right to use those as well. Otherwise, you could face, is this a fair use or do I have to pay to use what I have written previously? So now we're ready to move on to permissions.
Right. Well, and that's a good transition because having to get permission to use your own work would be sort of annoying. So Jeff makes a really good point about making sure when you sign a contract that you do reserve those rights for yourself. Permission, of course, is asking for consent to use material that belongs to someone else under copyright. And when you do that, you have to do it in writing. And I say that because I did work with at least one author who sort of said, well, these people are my friends and I'm sure they won't mind. And I talked to them about it. And so I think we should just be able to check this off as having permission. I don't know of any publisher that will accept that because it just won't hold up, if a question arises in the future. A permission request letter needs to describe exactly what you're planning to use and how you're planning to use it. So what is the print run of the book that you're publishing? Is it coming out as an e-book as well? If it's coming out in any electronic form, how many years do you want it to be able to be up, to be live? Is it going to be password protected? There are lots and lots of questions like that. Generally, when authors are contributing an article or are writing a book, the publisher will give them some sort of a model permission request letter and say, this is the information that you should give to the copyright holders when you ask for permission to use their stuff. If you're lucky, if you're writing, say, a college textbook, you may be able to get the publisher to provide you with the services of a permissions editor. That's something that I sometimes do on books. And sometimes I'm lucky enough to be able to be in touch directly with the author. A lot of other times I'm just given the manuscript and a list of things that the publisher believes are going to need permission. And so I don't get the enjoyment of working with the author, but I will often have queries for the author because in going through a manuscript, sometimes I can't tell whether something is quoted verbatim or whether it's just a summary that's being used with attribution. So one thing that you can do and do yourself a favor also is when you're putting together a manuscript for an article or a book, make it really clear what is quoted and what is summarized or paraphrased. And we will talk about summarizing and paraphrasing in more detail later. I think Jeff has more experience with journal permissions, journal authors.
Yes, and the first thing to say about that is, so far, I'm not aware of any journal article author who has been offered the services or been able to take advantage of the services of a permission editor provided by the publisher. So you may want to take advantage of somebody like a freelance editor like Elsa. It's easy to understand why journals don't provide permissions editors just from the sheer numbers. About 150,000 books published in the U.S. A couple of years ago, the same year there would have been at a minimum five times that number of journal articles. And that's why most copyright transfer agreements from journal publishers include language like this, and this is a direct quote. The author represents and warrants that the manuscript does not infringe the copyright or property right of another. That's the end of the quote, but that would include not only extended quotations that may go beyond fair use, but also using things like tables, illustrations, graphic materials for that article, whether you've reformatted them or not. So when you're writing journal articles, be aware that the publisher is anticipating, well, requiring that you have cleared your own permission.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, and I think it's pretty typical in book contracts that there will be a clause that says the author is ultimately the one who's responsible if there is any copyright infringement going on, whether the author has to handle permissions on his or her own or not. Practical tips for how to retain your sanity when you're clearing your permissions. I suggest setting up a database. I used to do it with index cards. Now I do it with a Word table where I have a separate column for the manuscript page, another one for the author of the material that's being quoted, another column for the rights holder, which will often be the publisher. Say it's coming from a book that was published by Random House. I'm going to put Random House in there. If later on, if I contact Random House and they say, well, for Canadian rights, you have to go to so-and-so, then I'll add another row for that, and I'll end up having two different rights holders for the same piece of content that's being used. And then I have a column to show when I placed a request, when I did follow-ups, and finally, which rights were granted and what the fee is that's being charged. Follow-ups are really important because it takes a long time to get answers out of many rights holders. It typically takes maybe 6 to 8 weeks. There are some people who will answer really, really quickly, and then there will be a lull, and there will be things that will drift in at the four-week point, at the six-week point. But I generally do follow-ups at about the 2 to 3 week point just to make sure that my request hasn't fallen into the cracks somewhere. And there are some rights holders that have to be hounded over and over and over again. If you're an introverted person, it can be really hard to make a pest of yourself trying to get an answer out of people, but it's just part of your job if you're an author or if you're a permissions editor. And so, you know, I write like, hate to be a pest, but we are running up against our deadline. We really need an answer, things like that. And there are some resources that you might want to take a look at. On the handout, I mentioned Copyright Clearance Center. They are going to be giving a teleconference later this fall. Is that right, Kim? Not sure if Kim is still with us, but I was told that Copyright Clearance is going to be doing a teleconference for TAA.
Yes,
they will tell
correct.
More.
At the end of the teleconference, I will give information about that teleconference, and so I'll leave it till the end.
Yes. Okay, thank you. They're a clearinghouse for copyrighted material. They especially work a lot with course pack materials. If you need things cleared for distribution in class, that was one of the first things when Copyright Clearance Center first went into business. That was one of the things that they specialized in doing. We also have, on the TAA website, there are a number of lawyers. There's a half a dozen lawyers or more that you can access to get a legal consultation if you have a question. And one of these, Lloyd Jassen, has posted an article on 10 common copyright permission myths, so that's good reading if you want to take a look at that. And then to be fair to my competitors, I mentioned a couple of other freelance permissions editors who do some of what I do. I don't really specialize in permissions. I do developmental editing. I love to work with the content when a book is being put together. But I also do permissions from time to time. Julie Harper specializes in permissions, and so does Ann Wallingford. So they are other people that you might want to check out if you're considering hiring somebody to help you with permissions.
Excuse me, Elsa?
Yes.
I was wondering if I could ask a question really quickly.
Let's go ahead. Yeah.
Can you just go over what columns you would have in your permission request database? I didn't get them all.
Probably the easiest thing is if you would email Jeff and me. We put our email addresses at the beginning of the handout. I'll just send you a sample.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, but basically I key everything to the manuscript page that it's on. I've seen other people, authors basically, I've seen sometimes try to assign a permission number to each item that they believe is going to need permission. And in my mind, that's a mistake because it just needlessly complicates things. And you may end up finding something else that needs permission and it'll bump your whole numbering system. You'd be keeping track of numbers for no good reason. So I don't do it that way, but I do key everything to the manuscript page that it's on because that way I can find it if I have to go back and look for it. Shall we move on to the question of plagiarism, summarizing, paraphrasing?
Yep.
Right, okay. I think this has become a bigger issue with the ease of copy and paste. I know when I'm working on writing myself, sometimes I'll grab something out of Wikipedia just to give me sort of a general idea of what it is, what I'm dealing with. And if I were sloppy and didn't highlight it or make some marking on my computer screen that this wasn't mine, it could end up, you know, getting into a finished piece, and it wouldn't be my words. Wikipedia sort of operates on the Creative Commons license that Jeff was talking about earlier, where they're not necessarily going to come after me and accuse me of violating their copyright, but it's still plagiarism. It's not my words. And I hate to say it, but within the past year, I've seen more of this type of thing in working on other authors' manuscripts, people who I really think ought to know better. I've been reading along in a manuscript, and I'll come to a couple of paragraphs that seem oddly well-organized, oddly authoritative, and I feel like, gee, the author really seems to know what he's talking about, just right here in this one little spot. And then I go, the tone of the writing, it just doesn't seem like the same author's voice. And sure enough, if I take part of a sentence and put it in quotation marks and Google it, I will find that it's taken verbatim from something else that's already on the internet. And that's not a good thing to be caught doing. It's one reason why we have editors, I guess, to catch these kind of things and go back tactfully to the author and say, this seems to already exist on so-and-so website. Do you want to rewrite it in your own words? Either that or give credit. That's what plagiarism is taking somebody else's words without giving credit, passing them off as your own. And again, I can understand how it can happen because it's so easy to go hunting around, Googling some topic that you want to write about, grab something that somebody else wrote that looks really cool, and stick it in your document, and then forget to make a note of where you got it so that you can either rewrite it yourself or give credit. I also have a little story about how not to rewrite in your own words. We once had an incident with, I think it was a study guide. There was no money to get permissions, and it came to light at sort of the last minute that the author had essentially used a whole story out of Newsweek or one of these other major magazines. The whole thing was quoted, and we couldn't, it was too late in the process to get rid of it. So we assigned a freelancer to rewrite the whole story in his own words. And when it came back, this freelancer was more of a copy editor, didn't have a lot of experience with writing. It was clear that what he had done was basically take a dictionary and a thesaurus and just look up synonyms for as many words as he could find. The result, as you can imagine, it was unreadable. It was not any idiomatic English writing style. It was just bizarre combinations of words. And he hadn't fulfilled the need to rewrite in your own words, because what you need to do is get to the ideas that are being expressed, not the sentence structure. You need to get down to the ideas and rewrite those ideas in your own words. And I think Jeff has a couple of books to recommend that you can read to help you understand the difference.
I do, thanks.
Yep.
This idea of paraphrasing or summarizing, even for experienced writers, it can be one of the most daunting things. You know that they've said it so well, so how do you capture what they've said without making some kind of extended quotation? I've recently read two different books that can provide some help on this. The first one is the book They Say, I Say, The Moves That Matter in Academic Writing by Gerald Grass and Kathy Berkenstein. It has several parts in the book, and part one includes three relatively short chapters. Chapter one reinforces why we do this, because we're part of an academic conversation. Other people have said things before we do, and we now have something to contribute. Chapter 2 deals with summarization, and Chapter 3 with quotation. So, very useful. Another book is Rewriting, How to Do Things with Text by Joseph Harris. And Harris's first chapter is entitled Coming to Terms, and it essentially covers that same ground as Part 1 of Graf and Berkenstein's book. But using both would give you a more holistic view of this. Elsa and I kind of practiced this teleconference with some friends earlier this week, and one of them pointed out, said, we've talked earlier about permissions, and you may not need permission to take an extended quotation. It may be a work that's in the public domain, but be sure that you attribute it to the original author so that you are not guilty of plagiarism. And the bibliographic citations for those books that I referred to are in your handout. Anything more on that, Elsa, before I jump into legislation?
No, I think we're ready to move on with legislation, and you're very up on a lot of this stuff because it affects you as a librarian.
It does indeed. Copyright is certainly not a dead issue. The Copyright Act was written in the most recent incarnation of the Copyright Act was 1976 in the United States, but goes back to the Constitution. The Constitution includes reference to copyright, and Elsa's already mentioned the Sonny Bono Term Extension Act, but there are other issues that may well affect you as an author, as an academic. One of them is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. DMCA was passed in 1998, and it included provisions that are now Section 1201 of the Copyright Act. And those provisions were ostensibly included to thwart piracy of digitally created materials. The unintended consequence, however, was that they have also completely thwarted fair use. Digital media can include copyright protection technologies, so that you can't make a copy, but if you not only can't make a whole copy, you can't even copy a small portion for what might be a fair use. If you disable the copyright protection technology, you've prima facie committed an illegal act, and therefore DMCA has had the effect of chilling fair use of some materials like that. Orphan Works legislation has been introduced recently, and just to put this in context, an orphan work is one for whom either you cannot identify who owns the copyright to the item, it may have been an anonymous work but is still copyrighted, or even if you can identify the copyright holder or owner, you cannot locate them to seek a permission that might go beyond fair use. And the Copyright Act of 1976 exacerbated this problem because it no longer required that you register materials to get a copyright. So there may not be any existing record of who the John Smith is that authored such a thing. There's been legislation introduced in 2006 and again in 2008, didn't pass in either one of those Congresses. It has not thus far been reintroduced, and partly that's because of a result of the Google Books Project. The Google Books Project, as you may well be aware, started in 2004 with Google going to 5 very large academic libraries and wanting to scan every book in their libraries. That resulted in the Association of American Publishers and the Authors Guild suing Google for infringement of copyright, because they were scanning copyrighted materials as well as materials in the public domain. Google's response was, we don't make those available to anyone. We only show a snippet if it's an in-copyright work. That didn't satisfy either AAP or the Authors Guild. And so there were negotiations entered into, and they came up with a settlement that they felt would satisfy all of the parties. That settlement was to have been ruled on finally or accepted just yesterday. However, in the last 4 months, more than 400 friend of the court briefs were filed, some of them absolutely lambasting the Google book settlement. And so that settlement has been set aside. However, there was news yesterday, and that is that they expect a revised settlement as early as next month. Why should you be concerned? As an author, if you hold the copyright to books that you have written, you'll need to let Google know whether they have the permission to include your work or to exclude it. It's actually, you need to tell them that you want your work excluded. It's one of these opt-out rather than opt-in. If the publisher holds copyright to materials that you have written, they will make that determination. You should be aware that if your book ever goes out of print, your contract might include a clause that the copyright would revert to you in that sense or in that case. And so you probably need to have a discussion with your publisher about whether your books will or will not be included in the Google database. This comes into play where orphan works are concerned because There is a book rights registry that will be set up by this settlement covering all works for the distribution of royalties to rights holders. And in the case of orphan works, you could get permission to use things, and then the royalties, if the rights holder came forward in the future, then those royalties could be distributed to them. Elsa's going to talk a little about Canada's orphan works, and then I'll return to two other pieces of legislation.
Right. Thanks, Jeff. Actually, I should also mention that just a little sidelight on the Google Books settlement, and some of you may remember there was an incident with Amazon and George Orwell's book 1984 that had been on Kindle and been sold to people who had Kindles, and then the book was removed from the people's Kindles.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a high school student who sued about that because he had put notes about the book 1984 on his Kindle, and they took his notes away too. They essentially ate his homework. And he won. This Reuters piece, Amazon has settled for $150,000, a lawsuit brought by a high school student and another consumer when 1984 was deleted from their Kindles because the student said that he lost his notes along with it. So these things can get really, really complicated, and you never know who all is going to be affected by them. About the orphan works, I remember hearing about this more than 10 years ago. It seems like a very sensible system that Canada has. It's called the unlocatable copyright owner. You have to show that you've done due diligence. They have a set of instructions for all the things that you have to try to find the copyright holder. And it has to be work that was published. It can't be an unpublished or something found in somebody's basement. And anyway, if you satisfy those conditions, then you can apply to the Copyright Board of Canada and get a limited license to use the material. So if the United States had something like that, it might be really useful for these frustrating cases where you just can't find a rights holder.
And if the orphan works legislation is reintroduced and passes, it wouldn't, as I understand the legislation, it wouldn't go quite as far as Canada's does, but it would go certainly a good distance toward, after you've done due diligence, being able to use the work and not being liable for statutory damages should the copyright holder come forward later and allege infringement. So we can hope that will actually be reintroduced and passed. Two more pieces of legislation very quickly. Both are related to what is called the NIH Public Access Policy. The NIH, or the National Institutes of Health, funds more than $28 billion of research every year, resulting in close to 80,000 separate journal articles annually. In 2004, they put forward a policy encouraging authors of NIH-funded research to deposit those articles in an openly accessible archive, so anyone with access to the internet could get to the article. They had very low uptake on that, and in April of 2008, that policy became mandatory. In order to receive continued funding from NIH, you have to deposit your article in PubMed Central, the openly accessible archive, or your publisher has to do it for you, within 12 months of the publication. So there can be a delay in its posting to the archive. In February of this year, Representative John Conyers, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, introduced a piece of legislation called the Fair Copyright and Research Works Act, Fair Copyright in Research Works Act. This act basically asserts that the government is taking copyright in those articles. There are many, I would say, reasonable and informed voices who say that that simply is not the case. You have the copyright when you write the article. You may subsequently transfer it to the publisher, but when you accept NIH's money, you own the copyright to any articles that are produced as a result of that. That legislation has not gone anywhere, and sources that I read say it's not likely to. At the same time, there has been another act introduced or reintroduced called the Federal Research Public Access Act, another FERPA, for those of you in the Academy. There's a different FERPA about educational records, but this one's about research being publicly accessible. If this act passes, it means that any articles coming out of research funded by any federal agency that has a budget of more than $100 million to fund research would also have to go into an openly accessible archive, similar to NIH's. So we have two very different competing views of legislation. Don't know at this point what the likelihood of the Federal Research Public Access Act is in terms of being passed, or whether it will die as it did the last time, but it's certainly something to be aware of. So that ends my talk about legislation, and I think we're at the point, unless Elsa has something specific to say, to take your questions.
Yeah, it sounds good. I just would encourage everybody to take a look at the resources that we listed at the end of the handout, where to get more info on copyright. We don't want to spend time walking you through those websites, but they're great places to go if you forgot something or if you have a further question beyond what we can answer. But, yeah, fire away.
Okay, I want to remind everyone to press 4-star to unmute yourself.
Hello, this is Jay Coakley, and we've been talking a lot about text, and I'm wondering about images. So the same rules apply for when they go into the public domain or not? Like if you want to use an old image from, you know, a 1904 Olympic Games or something like that.
Yep. Same rules apply. I've done quite a lot of photo editing as well as art editing of, you know, line art and things. Yes, the same rules apply as far as the duration of copyright. Finding the owner of an image can be even more of a challenge than finding the owner of a literary work. But yes, the same rules apply about the duration of copyright. Now, there are lots and lots of images in the Library of Congress and National Archives collections. Many of them are shot by military people, that's the same thing as a U.S. government publication. So those are out of copyright, even if they're recent. But then there are many other things. I think American Memory is the name of one of the areas on the Library of Congress website where they have lots and lots of photographs from like the 1920s and 30s, but a lot of them were shot by commercial photographers for popular magazines of the day, Look magazine, things like that. And those are not in the public domain. You can see them on the website, and you can even copy and paste them in low resolution. But if you want to actually publish them somewhere else, you have to track down the owner.
Jay, one of the things that you might want to be aware of, the Creative Commons website has a means of searching for images for which permissions have already been granted. So if you're not looking for a particular image, you're looking for an image to illustrate something in particular, but you don't know which image that is, you should be able to locate, well, I would hope you would be able to locate an image that you could use through that site. Either they're in the public domain or the creator of the image has already given permission for doing that. And I have not personally used Flickr, but I understand that there is at least a portion of Flickr, they call the Flickr Commons, where things that people put into Flickr Commons, they agree that they are freely usable by other people. So if you have a particular image that in mind, you may need to get permission for it. If you only have a general idea of a kind of image you'd like, you may be able to find one that you wouldn't need to seek permission to use.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Please.
If you received a letter from a public corporation that was addressed to you at your home or your business, would you then essentially own that letter and be able to put that letter exactly as it was sent to you in a book if you wanted?
No. The writer of the letter owns the copyright. When you say a public corporation, you don't mean U.S. government. You mean a publicly owned for-profit corporation or nonprofit?
Yes.
Yeah, they own it.
Yeah.
So even though they've sent you the letter to you, you don't own that letter?
Correct.
Okay.
It's essentially, you may own the letter, but you don't own the content of the letter.
It's kind of like buying a painting. If you buy a painting, it doesn't mean you own the copyright for that image.
Or a book. You can buy a book at a bookstore. You own the physical copy of the book, but you don't own the content of the intellectual content of the book.
Okay.
You raise a very interesting point there. We're very much in the habit of, at least I am, we get an email and we forward it. Even the act of forwarding, we're essentially using somebody's copyrighted work. They put it in a fixed, tangible medium, and we forward it off. That somebody, if they wanted to be persnickety, could allege infringement of their copyright.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for asking. Oh, and what is your name?
Deborah Barnett.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
My name is Veronica Watson, and my question is, what determines whether the publisher or the author retains the copyright? Is that just something that you negotiate at the point that you are contracting your book, or is there something else going on there?
No, it's contractual, and I think this comes up a lot when people want to self-publish, too. I've in the past year or two, dealt with some authors who are not necessarily academics, and they're writing something that is just meaningful for them, and they want to self-publish, and some of the companies that do self-publishing have in the fine print something that says that they own the copyright. Others don't, and so this has become kind of a conventional wisdom going around among people who want to self-publish. Make sure when you sign up with one of these that it's a company that allows you to hold on to your own copyright. But with commercial publishers, it's negotiable.
Just a word about that from not the book side, but the journal article side. It is very common practice for the journal publishers to send you a copyright transfer agreement that they have prepared. It's a standard agreement that transfers all rights to the publisher. Many of them have already prepared alternative agreements that leave copyright or very specific rights under copyright with the author. But you need to know that you can ask for that kind of a thing. So say, do you have an alternative agreement that would leave the copyright in my hands rather than transferring it to yours?
It's sort of a sidelight on that, too. I would say if somebody comes to you for permission for something that you've written, those things are negotiable, too. You may get a permission request letter that says, we want all rights for all future editions. We want all electronic media. We want the entire world in all languages. And you feel like you're being presented with a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. The fact is that you can go back to whoever sent you that request, and you can say, well, I'd love for you to use my material, but I don't want to give you all of these rights. And in most cases, many of those things are negotiable.
That's good to know.
Yeah, so thank you for asking that, Veronica.
Thank you.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.